I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Pope Francis has only been on the job for half a year, but in that time, he has shaken up the Vatican. He retired the papal limousine, signaled greater acceptance of gay Catholics, has criticized what he called a Vatican-centric church, saying that leaders have often been, quote, narcissists. He recently convened a group of cardinals to revamp the church bureaucracy. He says he wants to refocus the church on the plight of the poor. We asked Rocco Palmo to join us on Radio Times. He's been following all this on his blog, Whispers in the Loggia. And Rocco, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Anytime, Marty. Thanks for having me back.
You're very welcome. Let me toss out that phone number because I'd be really curious about the Catholics in our audience and what you make of what the Pope has been doing in the last 6 months. To give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can also email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. So are you surprised at what the Pope has been doing and saying in the last 6 months?
I never thought I'd see anything like this, Marty. And I've, you know, just with the last days of John Paul II, then the turbulence of Benedict's pontificate, but also, too, the stranglehold, if you will, in the Vatican that's been held by officials. I mean, the Italians see it as their birthright to run the Vatican after 500 years. And so now you have this guy from Latin America, came out of nowhere, wasn't really talked about before the conclave, and elected in 24 hours. You know, cardinals, before they went to the conclave, were saying, oh, we're not going to be out till Friday or Saturday, expecting 4 or 5 days of voting. And then, boom, there it was. And so, but also, I think even they're stunned that this guy at 76 is running circles around everybody, you know, busting the bubble that has surrounded the papacy and, you know, sometimes even driving himself around behind the Vatican walls.
Well, interesting. And I mean, there's so much we don't know about how a pope is selected. But, I mean, do you see him as a kind of a stealth candidate?
Well, he was the last—he was the runner-up in 2005 because he was respected enough in Rome, well-known enough, but non-Roman enough. He had never lived there, worked there, studied there, or anything. And so the— But they knew there were two priorities for the cardinals going into the conclave. The first is the reform of the Vatican, the Roman Curia, the government of the church, which had just been seen as getting too incestuous and too caught up in its own, too Vatican-centric, to use Francis' term. But the other priority was someone who could preach the gospel, who could be an evangelist. And to choose the name Francis, you know, when every temptation in the papacy is against the spirit, the poverty and the simplicity of Francis, you're surrounded by opulence and power, and you have absolute power in the church. So to choose that, there's a reason no pope ever has before, but that speaks not just to a gentleness and a care, but a sense of determination that I know I have the confidence to live up to it.
Well, and today is St. Francis Day, just to sort of add to what you just said there.
Yes, and he's actually been spending the day in Assisi, which is the town of St. Francis. Very dramatic moment, him going to the tomb. There are 200,000 people who've shown up and around 1,500, 2,000 journalists because he's been great for business, but he's just been an absolute sensation on the stage. And he called the church, he's doing 6 speeches today, which is almost unheard of for a papal. You usually have 2 or 3. And he's actually been throwing aside his text and saying, look, the church is called to strip itself of worldliness, to strip itself of arrogance. And he used the word to strip itself of bullying.
He used the word bullying
the Italian word for bullying. He said the church is called to strip itself of all of this and to be, like Francis, a humble witness in the world, which, you remember, Francis in Catholic theology in Catholic history was the barbarian at the gates telling the church to strip itself, to repent, and to embrace poverty to show the beauty of the gospel. To have that kind of a figure as the Pope is, you know, it's enough to make your head spin.
Well, he has done 2 really fascinating interviews, one with a very well-known newspaper a very liberal newspaper in Italy, edited by a well-known atheist. And apparently, according to your reporting, other reporting as well, is Pope Francis called up the editor. I mean, he initiated this interview that he wanted to give.
Yeah, the interview was with La Repubblica, which is actually the largest Italian daily, but it's the outlet of the left, the second— very secularist left, clearly. And so the former editor and the Pope actually had a dialogue of public letters over the summer about how do non-believers and Catholics work together? Is the job of Catholics to try and force, you know, non-believers into the church? And the Pope, you know, blew that off immediately and said, no, proselytism, to use his term, is solemn nonsense.
Yes.
But he called this guy up in his office. There was no please hold for the Pope. His secretary said, the Pope's on the phone. and he couldn't believe it.
You.
And then he hears, hello, I'm Pope Francis. You said you wanted to meet, and the Pope had his day book in front of him and said, he said, Monday doesn't work for me, Wednesday doesn't work for me, how's Tuesday for you? And nobody else knew. And only the night before, I got a tip off around 9:30 our time here. It was 3:30 in the morning in Rome saying, get ready, here comes another interview on the cover of Republica tomorrow.
Wow. Here's a quote here, and it's just, the words are just, they're so strong. He says, heads of the church have often been narcissists, flattered and thrilled by their courtiers. The court is the leprosy of the papacy. It is Vatican-centric. It sees and looks after the interests of the Vatican, which are still, for the most part, temporal interests. This Vatican-centric view neglects the world around us. I do not share this view. I will do everything I can to change it.
Yep. And he's shown that determination. He hasn't really been moving people out of offices so far. If anything, there's going to be a complete reform of the Roman Curia over the next 6 months to a year, led by the commission of eight cardinals, one of whom is Boston Sean O'Malley, who's been most famous for combating sex abuse in Boston after the eruption of 2002. But he's essentially, for the meanwhile, built himself a parallel structure so that the people in the offices have no idea, what he's doing until it happens. He has a couple trusted aides around him, and the rest of the time, he handles the phone. I mean, there was that phone call even a couple weeks ago. He received a letter from a woman who was having an affair with a married man and became pregnant, and he was pressuring her to abort, and she wrote the Pope saying, what do I do? And she just addressed the Pope Francis Vatican City, and she gets a call.
And what did he say?
The Pope, and he said, because she was afraid that there would be no one to baptize the baby, he said, please keep your baby. If you need any help, I'm here for you. And she said, I don't know if I'm going to have a priest to baptize. And he said, well, you always have me. Mm. And so she said, if the baby, if it's a boy or a girl, is going to be named Francis or Francesca in his honor. So, and he probably will do the baptism of the baby.
But do you think it's a tonal change, or do you think it's something more dramatic than that?
Well, obviously, it begins with tone in an institution like this, where, the formal vesture of the Pope is a white gown that comes from the 16th century, or that has its roots in the 16th century. The symbolic is the substantive, first off. In terms of teaching, if anything, the church has been unfairly portrayed, but it's a self-inflicted wound in many ways over the last 20, 30 years for, being this kind of enforcing doctrine. The doctrine will always be there. But it's interesting that in his interview with Civiltà Cattolica, with the Jesuit magazine, he talked about the development of doctrine, how science has helped the church come to greater realizations of things. There's a joke among bishops that, when the church changes its teaching, the line's going to be, well, it's what we always taught, we just haven't gotten there yet. But the church always has to exist between the two poles of the doctrine, the teaching, and pastoral practice, not turning anyone away, that, we're all in this together, and that everyone has a home here. And that part really hasn't been emphasized, but also, and that's at the forefront, because look at the stats, especially in the global north.
Well, because so many people have fled the church, you're saying.
Well, 10%, you're going to be talking about a Pew report in the next half hour. Yep. 10% of the entire American population were born Catholic and have left the church. Have left the church. The only reason the numbers stayed stable in the States is because of Hispanic immigration. Hispanics are about to become a majority of the American church. So to have a Latin American pope made much more sense than having a North American.
Let me do another quote, then we'll get to our callers again. This is from Pope Francis, and he said, this was to the interview to the is it called La Repubblica?
Mm-hmm.
In Italy, he says, the most serious of the evils that afflict the world these days are youth unemployment and the loneliness of the old.
Yeah. Well, he comes, and it's even for being Argentinian, remember, his family were immigrants from Italy. And he has that experience of, a very close, very tight family. Most influential person in his life weren't his parents, but his grandmother, his immigrant grandmother. And I come from that same experience, so it's actually very emotional for me to see that in him. But when he talks about, the elderly, he says that we commit a cultural euthanasia by basically consigning the elderly away and not looking to them for wisdom or experience and seeing them as something to be tolerated. And he's gone on repeatedly about the evils of the world economic system, which has left huge amounts of youth unemployment in Europe. Even in Brazil, where he went a couple months ago, there were riots over, government spending and the state of the economy.
He says the old need care and companionship, the young need work and hope.
Yeah.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Excuse me, we're talking about Pope Francis. He has been, as we have been saying, shaking things up at the Vatican. And we want to get your response to what he has been doing and saying. And again, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can also email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. We have Mike, and it looks like Mike is joining us from Westchester. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times, Mike.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Love the show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to mention, I know you were asking for calls from your Catholic audience. I am not Catholic, and the reason for that is my mother is Catholic, But when we were young, she made the conscious decision to raise us Methodist, which is what my father's was. In fact, she actually called it Catholic Light, which I took to mean that it didn't necessarily have some of the social, the extreme social views that the Catholic Church had. But I have to be honest with you, ever since the new Pope, you know, there has been a serious draw, at least for me as a non-Catholic, but familiar with Catholicism, there's been a serious draw back to Catholicism. And I was just wondering if there, you know, has been any evidence of that, of, you know, having people who weren't, but now are coming to maybe get closer to that.
Well, Mike, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Rocco, I was looking at some polling, and he, meaning Pope Francis, has high approval ratings among Catholics.
Huge approval. I mean, but even Pope Benedict had approval ratings mostly in the high 70s. But Francis, you're talking 88%, 89%. But, you know, it's still, again, it's still early in the game. There are people, you know, who have been very cautious in the church saying, oh, this honeymoon's going to end, this honeymoon's going to end. And I don't know about that, because clearly he's framed himself. And he had the ability to frame himself. He didn't have the baggage his predecessor did of 20 years as the Vatican's doctrinal cop, if you will. And so it's really like the early days of John Paul II, but that lasted for his whole pontificate. Even as John Paul was strident on church teaching, he was still the global dynamo. And he, remember, his funeral in 2005 was the most attended event in world history, 5 million people. But already Francis has drawn the biggest crowd in the history of the American continent, 3 million in Rio de Janeiro over the summer. And, of course, there was that great moment when he was driving through and they made a wrong turn and this people started throwing their babies in the car at him and he didn't roll the window up. He loved it.
Right?
Well, the rumor in Rome was actually that he asked for that wrong turn to be made because it was his first time, you know, outside of people who had to go through metal detectors since his election.
But do you think, I mean, this is asking you to get into the mind of, and the thinking of the Pope, but do you think because of his concern that people have been leaving the church, that, that the church has to do something to bring people back?
Well, I don't think you think about it in terms of marketing or, you know, market share, those kind of indicators, or saying, oh, look, you don't look at it in terms of stature. You look at it in terms of, you know, soul by soul. Human being by human being who comes to the church for refuge, for a bit of life, hope to get through tough times and to share their joys. And, you know, the church really is it, but it's the church walking together. And the fewer who are around, the less of a church we are. And so, again, you don't look at it in terms of the macro, you know, you look at it, or the doctrinal, you look at it in terms of the pastoral, because there are people saying, oh, the Catholics who've left are bad Catholics. No, I mean, it could be just one bad experience with a priest that can make people leave. And you see it especially at moments like weddings and funerals, you know, pastoral situations, or somebody who heard a bad homily and walked out one day or just wasn't feeling nourished. But the fact that he's able to do it, the most enthusiastic group I find about him aren't even, you know, people who've left the church or press or non-Catholics, but parish priests, because they feel like one of us is now in the big chair.
And that's Rocco Palmo, our guest today in this first half of Radio Times, second hour of the show. And we're talking about Pope Francis. And Rocco blogs at Whispers in the Loggia. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What do you think of Pope Francis? Give us a call. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, The Economist, covering news and ideas that interconnect the world to give readers a worldview. On newsstands, in bookstores, at economist.com, or on smartphones and tablets.
Your trees are about to deliver unto you a gift. Are you prepared to receive it correctly? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll celebrate 15 years on the air by helping you make gold for your garden. Plus, answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, Alfonso Cuarón's film Gravity opens tomorrow. We will talk about the impact that Mexican filmmakers are having in Hollywood.
The way they set up certain shots with oblique shots and close-ups and just really frenetic pacing break this linear narrative that Hollywood tends to go by.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY. Home is the place to express your style, and Calico celebrates their new store for designer fabrics and furnishings in Glen Eagle Square on Route 202 in Glen Mills. Grand opening events now through Saturday. More at calicocorners.com, a supporter of WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Rocco Palmo, who blogs at Whispers in the Loggia. We are talking about Pope Francis has been making a fair amount of news since he became Pope earlier this year. He is working to clean up the Vatican bureaucracy. He wants to refocus the church on the poor. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Rocco, I do want to talk about the Gang of Eight, but first let me get Andrea from Cobb Creek to join us. Andrea, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to say that, first of all, I'm not Catholic. I'm Protestant. But I wanted to say that, and what he's doing, he's leaving a lot of the pomp and circumstance and the Philly stuff in the dust, and he's doing, like, he's emulating what Jesus did. I can't remember where it is in the Bible, but he took his, Jesus took his rabbi's robe off and washed the feet of his disciples. And, you know, like, in how Pope is, how the Pope is going about, you know, like, just changing everything in the Catholic Church. He's emulating Jesus and doing it. So,
well, Andrea,
I think that's a beautiful thing.
And I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Rocco, you want to respond to
Well,
that?
You know, the washing of the feet, obviously, is a very symbolic moment. And Francis, actually, within 2 weeks of his election, normally it would be held in St. John Lateran, the Cathedral Church of Rome, the gorgeous, opulent place. It's been held there since the 1300s. Well, Francis decided to go to a youth prison in the city, continuing the practice he had done as Archbishop of Buenos Aires, and washed the feet of 12 young inmates, including a couple young women, and one of whom was Muslim, and which, you know, in certain circles in the church went over real well. But he keeps talking about the peripheries of existence. And when you look at the teachings, when you look at the Gospels, when you look at Jesus, you know, he always brought comfort to the afflicted, and afflicted the comfortable. And Francis is doing the same thing. Yesterday, there was a shipwreck off the Italian coast real quick. 200 people died, 200 migrants trying to come to Italy. And he threw aside his prepared text in a meeting, and he just said, this is a disgrace. And the world has to work together to, you know, this should never happen again. And he actually went to that island a couple months ago. That was his first trip outside Rome. And so it is very resemblant.
Interesting. Well, he did convene 8 cardinals from around the world, mm-hmm. actually, to come to be his council. They've been called the Gang of Eight. I don't know if the Pope calls them the Gang of Eight, but nonetheless, he is using their expertise to bring about reforms within the Vatican.
Well, it's interesting because the cardinals, again, this is part of the, you know, traditionally the entire College of Cardinals, roughly 200 of them around the world, have been the principal advisors to the Pope. This is unprecedented. This is actually, some Italian historians have called this the most significant development in papal governance since the, you know, 11th century.
Really?
Yeah, and because, you know, as opposed to the Pope dealing through the official channels of the Curia, here you have a meeting with the heads of the offices 3-4 times a year. He's calling these guys, you know, 2 times a week. And they were all, when they had, in advance of their first meeting, each of them were expected to bring a U-Haul's worth of proposals to Rome as to how to change. And they said, we're not just going to tweak the structure. It's basically going to be scrapped. And again, you have offices going back to the 14, 1500s here. And it's going to be made fit for purpose, but also fit for mission.
But it's interesting to imagine the sort of more established members of the Vatican. I mean, how they are viewing these very, I mean, they're bureaucratic changes, yeah. But they have an amazing
huge impact. And you know, the other change it's a change of phrase, but it's also a change of substance. He said the Roman Curia of the Vatican is at the service of the Pope, but also the bishops around the world. Now, you've had American bishops and bishops elsewhere complain that for 30 years, some junior Monsignor in Rome would send them orders. Nobody else would know, and they'd have to follow it or else get slapped down by the Curia, by the bureaucracy. So for the Pope to say that the Vatican is at their service and not the overlord is a huge thing. But he's also been talking in general, not just the Gang of Eight is one example, about what we call collegiality, you know, basically devolving power, devolving decision-making authority away from Rome, that the local churches decide what's best for them, that Episcopal conferences like the U.S. Conference of Bishops, any, you know, National Conference of Bishops, they were tolerated by Rome for the last 30 years. And now, you know, the Pope even told the people today, and it's easy, a bishop can't run his diocese without a pastoral council, which is lay people. I'm actually on the pastoral council here in Philadelphia, which is just established. And that's a huge shift for a clericalist, very courtly environment.
Well, and he said clericalism has nothing to do with Christianity.
Well, clericalism, when you look at it, is the root cause of the abuse crisis, because you've seen on the left and the right in the church, it's like the blue wall of silence among police. You know, the desire to protect your own and just see those who are in hurt as, you know, leave them aside. And so he gets crazy. But he said even he becomes anti-clerical when he sees a clericalist priest, when he sees an officious priest.
Wow.
Now, that's the Pope saying that.
I do want to get back to our callers, but yeah. One little quick thing I noticed is that the Vatican Bank has issued its first, I guess, report.
Externally audited report,
So obviously a little more or some more transparency related to the Vatican Bank.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because they actually said the transparency is going to be deleterious to them because there have been different entities that have, you know, not wanted that transparency from the bank, and it seems like they may be putting their accounts elsewhere. But he's drilling into the bank, you know, and people have been throwing things at him in the Italian press. You know, people opposed to it have been trying to basically blackmail some of the people he's called in to help him with the bank, and it's because they, you know, for them, it's just, for the old establishment, it's a sacred cow, perhaps the most sacred cow.
Well, let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. We want to know what you think of what Pope Francis has been doing and saying in the last 6 months. And we have Donna from, looks like Ambler, joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Donna. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. I'm one of those lapsed Catholics, and this guy has changed the world with his message. I want to tell you, he gets the message that was given to us 2,000 years ago, not running around in little white slippers or red slippers, whichever one the Pope used to run around in. All that pomp and circumstance over nothing. Now we finally got somebody in there who gives the message of love and peace. That's all I've got to say. I love this guy. He's going to make a difference.
Well, Donna,
stay healthy.
Thank you for the call to Radio Times. I mean, I'm assuming that this would warm Pope Francis's heart.
I think he's working harder than any of us who are covering him. We're just trying to keep up, though. But, you know, the amazing thing is he's talked about in Assisi, he's talked about it. He basically says, look, you can't just look at me and say, oh, isn't this wonderful? You know, he's calling all of us, Catholic, non-Catholic, all people of goodwill, to consider what do we do in our lives for those who are on the margins? How much life do we bring people? Do we, you know, what do we give? And that's the only way he's really going to make a change, is if more of us kind of consider that. And again, Catholics and non, and the, you know, because look, he declared a day of fasting and prayer for peace in Syria as it looked like we were going to conflict. And lo and behold, within a week there was an agreement. Unthinkable. And he used the bully pulpit to say, look, I want the whole church to join me in this. And apparently something happened.
Just one more question before we have to say goodbye to you. And he said this to the Jesuit magazine, in a sense, you know, stop so much obsessive focus on things like contraception, abortion, and homosexuality. But nonetheless, it's hard to imagine that the church or even the Pope would change the actual position of the church on those issues.
Well, again, the church always has to exist between the teaching and pastoral practice, walking with people where they're at and embracing them. But it's like, you know, the focus on teachings, it's kind of like walking up to somebody you meet in a bar or whatever situation you want to date and saying, okay, you're not going to cheat on me. You know, you're not, these are the rules. But you have to form a relationship with them first. And that's all that becomes easily understood. You don't put the cart before the horse.
And just one final question. Any way to sort of gauge the response of, let's say, conservative Catholics who, you know, perhaps unlike some of the Catholics that have called into our show saying that they're happy to hear what the Pope is saying, are there also disgruntled Catholics because of what he's saying?
Yeah, the Pope's never going to, you know, the toughest constituency for any Pope to win over is the church. Or a lot of the church. I mean, because you have this ferociously polarized environment, which echoes the divisions in American politics. It's also the case in Europe. But what Francis keeps saying is that this divided church has basically been, and he talks about Satan, a lot, brow raising extent, that basically this is playing into the hands of the devil. And if the church wants to look around for what's caused the decline in its witness in the world, we have no one to blame but ourselves first.
Well, Rocco Palmo, thank you very much for joining us today.
Anytime,
on
Marty.
Radio Times. And you can read his blog. It's called Whispers in the Loggia. Well, a new survey by the Pew Research Center's Religion and Public Life Project found that Jews in America have been undergoing a significant change when it comes to their religion. They continue to intermarry at a high rate, about 58%. Most do not belong to a synagogue, and about 22% say they have no religion. Yet a significant number of Jews have said that they have a, quote, strong sense of belonging to the Jewish people. Does this sound like you? Give us a call. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We asked Jane Eisner to join us. She's editor-in-chief of the Jewish Daily Forward. That's a national weekly newspaper. And Jane Eisner, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. It's been a couple of years.
Oh, it has. And it's so nice to hear your voice, Marty.
Thanks so much. Are you surprised by these findings from the Pew Research Report?
I think we weren't surprised about the trend. We were surprised about the intensity. I've been working on this project with Pew for several years now, and the reason I had initially approached them is because we didn't have good data on the Jews. You know, we're still a very small population. We found that we're about 2.2% of the American public. And it's very difficult to research a group that small, but Pew can do that. And I think they did a fantastic job from a very academic, careful, neutral way. They were not interested, really, in what the results were going to be. They just wanted them to be as accurate as possible. And so as we learned more and more about the results, I think that the intensity of intermarriage, especially among the non-Orthodox, and the growth of this group of Jews who don't feel that they are Jewish by religion really did surprise us.
Well, and intermarriage, that is a trend that has been going on for some time now, but it's as Pew seemed to discover, more than 50% of Jews are marrying out of their religion.
Well, that's true. And actually, that number, which is closer to 58%, has held steady for almost a decade. However, what we're seeing is among Jews who are not Orthodox, the number is much higher.
Right. In the 70s.
For those non-Orthodox Jews who've gotten married since the year 2000, 72% married non-Jews. And since the Orthodox do marry younger and more frequently and have more children, I think we're seeing a growing polarization between Orthodox Jews and everyone else.
For those Jews that are marrying out of their Judaism, is it a sort of a trend of assimilation? Is it a rejection of the church? I'm sure they're, you know, depending on who you're talking to, you're going to come up with a different answer. But it's right there in front of our faces.
Well, it's true. And first of all, I would never stand in judgment of anyone in terms of their choices for life partners. I think a lot of this stems from the incredible acceptance of Jews in American culture. I mean, think about it. In the last few years, the vice president's daughter married a non-Jew. The secretary of state's daughter married a non-Jew. Is not Jewish and married a Jew. So we're seeing, you know, sort of high profile intermarriage accepted everywhere. And I think from many people that I've spoken to believe that they don't have to give up their religion or their ties to the Jewish people if they are married to a non-Jewish spouse. And while we very much believe that they believe that, unfortunately, the numbers overall show otherwise.
Well, what's interesting, and just picking up on that, is that according to this Pew report, a sizable number of Jews think that it's, you can be Jewish and have a Christmas tree, you can be Jewish and believe that Jesus is a Messiah. I mean, it's an interesting, people talk about cafeteria Catholics that kind of pick and choose what they want to believe. Are we seeing some version of that among Jewish Americans?
Yes. Now, I think we do need to put this in historical perspective. I mean, there's been, for many centuries now, a very strong strain of what we call secular or cultural Judaism, people who feel very attached to the Jewish people but are not religiously observant. Indeed, you know, most Israelis are not religiously observant. And that is just as valid for many people as you know, going to synagogue every week or keeping kosher, et cetera. But this survey did point out, as you mentioned, Marty, this kind of blending of Judaism and Christianity that's not just about Jews, it's also about Christians.
Right.
There are a sizable number of people in the survey who felt they were, and this is their definition, sort of Jews by affinity, who are Christians who care a lot about the Jewish people. You know, around the office we kind of call them the Jewish fan club. I think that this too is a sign of growing acceptance and tolerance within American society. Some of the bigger studies of religious practice among all Americans have shown that there's a great deal of fluidity between and among religions and denominations, and you know, Jews are a part of that. The thing is, we're so small, and I believe what we have is so precious that I worry personally and sort of institutionally a great deal that we are losing our distinctiveness.
Well, what's interesting, and again, going back to this report, is that a number of Jews, a good percentage of Jews, are not observant, religiously observant. Most do not belong to a synagogue, but many still identify themselves as being Jewish. And, I'm not sure that would be true with other faiths, but it seems to be a strong identity for Jewish people.
It is, and what we learned in the survey was that a lot of that identity is based on remembering the Holocaust. A lot of it is based on the belief that Judaism tells us to lead an ethical and moral life, to care about others, to promote social justice. All those attributes were very, very high in the survey. We see that Jews are unusually concerned about discrimination against other Americans, especially African Americans and Muslim Americans. So I think that there's this kind of elevated social consciousness that does characterize a lot of Jewish thought and behavior, and I think it's how a lot of Jews identify themselves. You know, they identify themselves because we're supposed to care about others. And that's really true. I mean, the commandment to care for the stranger is the one that's most repeated in the Torah, more than anything else. You know, it's way more important than don't eat shellfish. And so in that sense, they really are following a very strong Jewish tradition. The troubling part of it is that that we're also finding that among those Jews of no religion or Jews who have intermarried, they have very tenuous ties to the community. They're much less likely to give to Jewish charities, to support Jewish causes, to educate their children Jewishly, to raise them Jewishly. And so that's the worry there. It's not the religion per se, it's the way the religion creates a tie to the community that we think, those of us who are tied to the community, think it's really important to maintain.
That's Jane Eisner, editor-in-chief of the Jewish Daily Forward. We asked her to join us in this portion of Radio Times to talk about this new survey by the Pew Research Center's Religion and Public Life Project, finding that Jews in America have been undergoing a significant change when it comes to their religion. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, also opening up the phones at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We talked about Catholics in the first half of the show, and now we're talking about Jews. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Montgomery School, an independent co-ed day school for pre-K through grade 8 in Chester Springs, supports WHYY. Montgomery School believes that when children find joy in learning, they are forever inspired to explore their world and are prepared to succeed in their educational pursuits and beyond. The school will host an open house Thursday, October 10th at 7 p.m. Details at montgomeryschool.org/admissions. Montgomery School, inspired to explore, prepared to succeed.
The new Showtime series, Masters of Sex, is based on the book by Thomas Mayer about Masters and Johnson, the team that conducted controversial research into human sexuality based on observing volunteers engaged in the act.
They conducted their studies with the secrecy of a CIA operation.
Thomas Mayer on The Next Fresh Air. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
What's life really like for the uninsured?
It's a frightening experience. It's a frightening thought. We tend to put our health care on the back burner, so to speak.
That's patient Warren Steptoe in a new documentary on health care called The Waiting Room. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about a new study by the Pew Center's Religion and Public Life Project. They found that more American Jews are becoming less religiously observant, although many still retain a strong Jewish identity. Our guest again is Jane Eisner. She's editor-in-chief of the Jewish Daily Forward. Jane, let me get some callers in on the conversation. We have Tamar joining us from Abington, Pennsylvania. And go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm Jewish, and my husband is not Jewish, and we have two young children who are in Jewish preschool, and we've agreed to raise our children with Jewish traditions and also some of his family traditions, which come from a more Christian background. And I'll say that, you know, we've had a really hard time finding a synagogue that has been welcoming to our family. We currently belong to a Reform synagogue in the area, but have had a really hard time integrating into it. And I would encourage clergy across the Jewish tradition, particularly in Reform Judaism and Reconstructionist Judaism, to start embracing interfaith families and making us feel more part of the community. By not doing so, we potentially won't join a synagogue or would join a different synagogue, even though Jewish tradition is important to our family.
Well, it's a great call, Tamar. And let me give Jane Eisner a chance to respond to that. And Jane, you were talking about the importance of community and tradition.
True. And, Tamar is an amazing example of a lot of what we are seeing. You know, technically, you are a Jew in the Reform movement if either your mother or father are Jewish, because she's the Jew in the family, even observant Jews would consider her children Jewish. But there's more than just, signing on the dotted line there. There's also the question of cultural and spiritual acceptance. And certainly coming out of this survey, what some people are saying is that it points to the need for more acceptance of families with different faiths. Now, I can also imagine many rabbis and other Jewish leaders worrying about that, because when you accept and embrace and say it's okay, then there's nothing left of saying, gosh, you know, one of your responsibilities as a Jew is to create a Jewish family with a Jewish spouse. And so that's where the tension lies. And I think particularly for the Reform and even the conservative movement, there have to be some really serious conversations about how to make families feel much more included and accepted, and yet still sort of say, you know, we think that the Jewish way of life is the one that we think is worth preserving for other Jews.
Do you think it also explains, and I know a number of Jews who, looking for a religious community, end up going to Quaker meeting. I mean, that they find that that's a place where they can express their religious faith.
I'm sure that that's true. I have to say that there's probably a lot more Quakers in Philly than there are in New York.
Probably true.
But one of the things that the survey detailed really with amazing precision is the switching of denominations. And what we found is that the retention rate, if you will, of, for people who were born into a certain denomination is quite low. Lowest for conservative Jews, only a little more than a third of people who were born conservative Jews have remained that way. Higher for Orthodox and Reform, but still pretty high. And in most cases, the switch goes from more observant, stricter denominations to looser, less observant denominations. There's a little bit, you know, of movement of Reform Jews becoming conservative and conservative Jews becoming Orthodox, but it's much bigger in the other direction. And so while there may, we don't know how many Jews have become Quaker, we do know that a great many Jews, particularly Reform Jews, or people who were born Reform Jews, end up falling into that category of Jews of no religion.
Oh, interesting. And that was, what, something like 22%, look, going back to this Pew report. Let me see what looks like Gideon from Brewery Town has to say. Gideon, go ahead, your Radio Times.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good. I really like the topic of this show.
Thank
you. Kind of echoes a lot of the feelings that that I have and some of the experiences that I've also had. My wife is originally from Jamaica, and there's this overwhelming feeling in some parts of Jewish families that for some reason we have to be incredibly pure and really keep our community really with its community and having children, you know, out of that community. And that kind of carries across to a lot of people, you know, who would call themselves Jewish, like I do. I feel a very strong attachment to my culture, to my people that way. I very strongly identify as that. But there's just this feeling of like purity, even among people who aren't at all religious. And it's just this interesting kind of a pull back and forth.
Well, Gideon, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I'd be curious, Jane, about your thoughts.
Well, I feel for Gideon. I'm sure he's right, but I also feel quite certain that that is not the the prominent and most important Jewish value. I mean, we have, as a people, always welcomed converts. I mean, the Book of Ruth is about a convert. And I think that while we certainly sort of act sometimes like a tribe, you know, so do other ethnic and racial and religious groups. To me, the challenge is going to be to really welcome people who want to be part of our faith and our cultural tradition, and to do that in a way that doesn't sort of dilute it and muddy the waters, but really brings a whole new set of ideas and perspectives and ways of living to this, you know, a religion that is, if it's going to survive, has got to be kind of organic.
Gideon, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Jane, you had mentioned some of the more conservative or even orthodox strains of the Jewish religion, and it seems that there's still an attraction there for a number of Jewish people who like those very conservative and orthodox ideas and traditions.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the Federation here in New York did a major survey of the New York Legion that was released recently, and it showed a surging population of Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox, what we call the Haredim, in this area. And indeed, you know, it's hard to walk down the street in New York and not see people who are visibly Orthodox. And so I think that in New York, in Los Angeles, in other enclaves, we are seeing an increase in Orthodox, in the number of Orthodox Jews. The survey did not show the increase to be as big as we all thought it might be. It's about Orthodox Jews comprise about 10% of American Jews. However, I think you have to probe a little deeper and look at the fact that there's many more younger Orthodox Jews who are staying with that way of faith. They are marrying earlier. They are having more children. The fertility rate is much higher among Orthodox Jews than non-Orthodox Jews. And so I suspect that were we to do this survey again in 10 years' time, and I sure hope we will, that we'll see that 10% number rise proportionately.
Let me see what Bill from Belmont Hills has to say. Bill, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. Thanks.
Hi there. Sure.
Hi. I was raised Reformed Jew. I identify as Jewish, but I'm a lifelong atheist. And for people like me or who are humanistic or secular Jews, if you're intermarried, if you're a gay couple, you're going to be hard-pressed to find a welcoming Orthodox, conservative, or Reform congregation. And there are alternatives. I mean, there's a Shir Shalom community for humanistic Jews and secular Jews here in Philadelphia. You have Jewish Children's Social for education. And we have, nationwide, we have the Society for Humanistic Judaism. And all these places are very welcoming. They're Jewish. We're all Jewish. But they're very welcoming to groups that don't fit in or feel uncomfortable in traditional settings. And I would just encourage people to look on the internet and see where you can find a home, because you know, things are changing, and and what we do in humanistic Judaism is we recast traditional holidays, Jewish holidays, to non-theistic action. In other words, it's this world oriented rather than other world oriented. So again, it's Jewish Children's Folk Show or Shul Shalom locally.
Well, Bill, thanks for the call to Radio Times, and Jane, I'm sure that doesn't surprise you.
It doesn't. I think the numbers are still very small, but as you could hear in Bill's voice, there's a lot of passion there. I want to use this opportunity, though, to explain that this survey did not make those kinds of judgments. If you were called on this survey and to get a really representative sample, they had to call something like 70,000 people, and you said you were Jewish, then you were counted as a Jew. You could be an atheist or a believer. You could keep kosher or not. Then your behaviors and your beliefs were probed, but we didn't stand in judgment of how anybody else describes themselves. If you say you're a Jew, then for the purpose of this survey, you are a Jew.
But I sense from both your voice, Jane, and some of the things that you've been saying that you are concerned that so many Jewish people don't feel this strong connection to their religion, to some of the traditions, some of the things that have held Jews together for 2,000 years.
Well, it's true. I am personally concerned because those things are a big part of my life and very, very meaningful. And I hoped I've raised my children to also value those aspects of being Jewish. But, you know, I again, don't want to stand in judgment of someone else's, you know, theology or lack thereof. My concern from a community perspective is that Jews who say they have no religion or Jews who intermarry, on the whole, I'm sure we can find exceptions, but on the whole, they tend not to be as connected to the community. They tend not to give to charities as much. They tend not to care about the community. This is what they say in the survey. They don't necessarily educate their children in this way or care about Israel as much. And I worry about what's going to happen to us. You know, our first job in many ways outside of our family as Jews is to care for the needy and the poor and the unfortunate. And who's going to support those efforts? How are we going to maintain our language and our education and our traditions in whatever way you want to express them, whether they're humanist or Orthodox? But still, it's that connectedness that I think I found underlying this survey and that I just personally really worry about.
Let me just read something quickly off the survey. The question was, what does it mean to be Jewish? And this is in the most popular answer, I should say, is remembering the Holocaust, followed by leading an ethical, moral life, working for justice, equality, being intellectually curious, caring about Israel, having a good sense of humor, being part of a Jewish community, observing Jewish law, and eating traditional Jewish foods. That was on the bottom of the list. And it's an interesting, I think, really provocative list of ideas there, Jane.
It is. I mean, there was a
lot. Sounds very Jewish to me, I have to say.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, there was a lot of comment about how many, more than twice as many Jews believe that having a sense of humor
exactly.
is essential for being Jewish than following religious law.
Right.
Okay, you know, I'm all for that. We have a hilarious column in the Forward and online this week by Dan Friedman, our managing editor, who is way funnier than I am, riffing off of that, you know, we're not the chosen people anymore. We're the John Stewart people.
Exactly. I read that.
And I think you do see this sort of, as I mentioned earlier, this kind of constellation of behaviors and beliefs that do point to a sense that we are on this earth to lead ethical and moral lives and to care about others. You know, again, my caveat there is most faith traditions preach that. I have Catholic friends who are just awesome when it comes to caring for the poor. And we, I think, as Jews, it's incumbent upon us to understand the framework in which our religion teaches us to do that and mm-hmm. how we express those values in a Jewish context that, to some degree, may set us apart from others, even though the final goal may be the same.
Let me squeeze one more caller in, and we have Rena from West Philadelphia. Rena, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was raised conservative Jewish and was fortunate to have a very meaningful Jewish education, both formally and informally, through summer camp. And it really allowed me to probe, deep questions of the meaning behind traditions that really gave me a very strong Jewish identity. And I'm curious what your guest has to say about the changes and trends in Jewish education, because I think during those formative years, it's really important to have a strong connection that isn't just based out of fear or, that you're not going to be remembering those who passed away in the Holocaust, but really, that's very important, but also just how are you connected to the tradition in a very positive way, and that really later on in life will influence your decisions about who you choose to marry and how you raise your kids. And I just am concerned, too, about how our Jewish education is really almost avoiding those bigger questions and that deep meaning that really would help Jewish youth today develop that strong Jewish identity.
Well, Rena, I really appreciate you calling. Jane, I apologize. You have 30 seconds to answer her very important question.
Well, Rena, you're absolutely right. And I think that if we're going to maintain a vibrant, pluralistic, I hope, egalitarian community, it's going to be because women and men like yourself have the educational experiences to really craft a tradition onto the modern world.
Rena, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Jane Eisner, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
It was a pleasure, Marty. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And she's editor-in-chief of the Jewish Daily Forward, and we asked her to talk about a new study by the Pew Center's Religion and Public Life Project. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program. You can message us on Facebook. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or at Marty Moss Cohen, MartyMossCoane. You can also send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. The intern for Radio Times is Jessica Crocker, Joyce Lieberman, WHYY Supervisory Engineer. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscow, and have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us.